Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, we welcome Dr. Mike Strauss in studio with us. Ken, it's been a busy season with our visiting scholar program, and we are pleased to feature another fine scholar today. Welcome, Mike. You are no stranger to this listening audience, but just a brief intro. You're a professor of physics at the University of Oklahoma, a popular speaker and author of a new book, The Creator Revealed. We're going to unpackage more of your bio as we go here, but Ken, tell us why we even invited Dr. Mike Strauss with us, and he's been all over the place. In fact, you told us where you've been, or all around the world before you got here.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to Straight Thinking.
It's good to be here. Yes, I was at a workshop in Tokyo just last week.
Wow. Well, we're going to ask you some questions, Mike. I know you came from a Christian family, and one of the questions I want to begin with is, I remember having a conversation in my office a number of months ago, and a lot of us, probably a lot of people listening, think that, you know, if you teach at a scientific, if you teach at an academic school in science, the scientists there are going to be hostile to the Christian worldview. And when I ask you that question, you had an interesting take from my point of view. And I wonder if you would tell me, I mean, what you have lunch with your science colleagues. I'm sure they know to some degree about your Christian commitment and things of that nature. What do you think most science folks think about Christianity if they come from a secular background?
Yeah. Well, there are certainly some who are antagonistic towards it, and you know, we know of books written by them. But I would say the biggest attitude towards Christianity is just apathy. So it's interesting that you bring up lunch, because there are about eight people who do experimental or elementary particle physics at the University of Oklahoma, where I'm a professor. And once a week, all eight of us go out to lunch. And we talk literally about everything you can think of, you know, students and family occasionally, and Oklahoma football, of course, because that's the most important thing. And then, so once I just said to my colleagues, we talk about everything. Why do we never talk about religion? And one of the responses was, because religion's not worth talking about.
Wow.
Right? So where do you go from there? Now, I would say that of the eight or so, a third of them are probably pretty antagonistic, and another half of them are probably half maybe antagonistic, half maybe deist kind of people. And then there's one who's actually a Christian as well as me. He's the only one I know in the department, and he's in the same field as me. So apathy is probably the biggest emotion or the biggest response I get to what I do. You know, they know I give talks on science Christianity. It's really irrelevant to them and their worldview.
So if I were to, you know, go down to a place where I worked with a group of auto mechanics, or if I went and, you know, worked in a grocery store and we had lunch and we talked, I mean, is it similar to the other walks of life where a lot of times, well, why should I care about this?
Yeah.
I guess because we're tempted to think everybody must be hostile to this if they're a scientist, but that's not your experience.
No. And I'm not sure it's the experience, like you said, of other walks of life. My students are highly interested. I mean, I don't make a big profession of my faith in the classroom. I'm trying to be sensitive to where they're coming from. But, you know, students here, I'm a Christian, and are constantly coming to my office and say, tell me how you can be a Christian and a scientist.
Wow.
But the professors don't seem to have that same curiosity.
Does that change at all when there's a tornado that comes through the area? Just curious.
No, you know, I spent many years in California, and I'll take tornadoes over earthquakes any day.
Wow. Okay.
Mike, let me ask a further question along that line. sometimes when I give talks for Reasons to Believe, I will say, you know, Christianity has influenced science really, I think, strongly along two lines. One is historically. I mean, this revolution in thought in the 1600s, a lot of these founding fathers, you know, Pascal, Copernicus, a lot of these people are deeply Christian in their orientation. And so a historical element, it's not to say that the Greeks and the Romans and the Chinese didn't make contributions toward science and technology, but there's a historical connection between Christianity. And the other one I say is philosophically. To do science, there are a lot of really critical philosophical assumptions. The real world out there, that world is uniform. You can trust your cognitive faculties, sensory organs, math and logic work. Do scientists that you interact with know of that historical and philosophical connection?
Yeah, let's address the philosophical first. I would say probably not. I mean, scientists are pretty myopic in what they're looking at, right? They're doing their research subject. They seldom think about the philosophical underpinnings of a rational world that they're trying to research. It's just a given. And I don't think, you know, scientists think that deeply about the philosophical ramifications or the underpinnings or anything else other than the paper I'm working on in some sense. As far as the other one, it's interesting. I just heard a debate, and I'm trying to remember who was in the debate, but it was a Christian and a very antagonistic scientist. And that very point was brought up, that previous scientists have been, you know, great thinkers and profound Christians. And what the skeptic attributed that to is just part of the culture they lived in. Mm. That if they lived in today's culture, they would be more enlightened, and Faraday and Maxwell and Newton would not be professing Christians.
Wow.
And I just thought, you know, how naive can you be? That's the best argument you can come up with.
Now, you know, as we think about this, you know, this idea that I'm interested in what's right in front of me, I'm working on this paper, or I've got this project that I'm working on. I mean, in a lot of ways, the way you describe maybe some of your science colleagues is the way I've experienced in other fields, yeah, where people are, hey, I grant you there are these big questions of life, but you know what? I'm really trying to deal with my family and my employment and the things that happen day to day. I guess, again, we're kind of tempted to think as a non-scientist that there is this built-in hostility. Yeah. And I know that it exists for some.
Yeah.
But you're talking about apathy, and you're talking about, well, what's my practical priority?
Well, and I think also, you know, many scientists really think, are naturalists, you know, philosophical naturalists. And that foundation is not even questioned. And so I just think that most would say, show me something about any religion that makes it relevant, or show me something about any religion that can fit into my worldview of philosophical naturalism, right? And that's pretty tough to do by definition. And so I just think, you know, if somebody from Reasons to Believe was to come and give a talk at the University of Oklahoma on science and Christianity, I don't think you would get much interest from the scientists to actually even want to come and investigate it.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, it's such a phenomena that I don't totally understand, because I agree, they must think about the big issues of life.
Well, I have exactly the same experience in my involvement at Caltech and at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Apathy. I mean, they just don't, they're not necessarily antagonistic. There's a few that have been, mm-hmm, that are quite outspoken, but the most, they're happy to let you. I think they're preoccupied, as you say, with what they're working on, and that takes up all of their time. Yeah. And they don't have time to think, you know, if they have a family, of course, there's those responsibilities. But, you know, I think they're scientists because they have been very dedicated to developing their skills and giving the time to the particular subject that they're involved in. And they don't want to think too much about other stuff.
Yeah, or they don't think that it's worthwhile to think about other stuff.
Right.
You know, and that's why I preface this question that I ask them by saying we do talk about other things that are important, like OU football. So, you know, why don't we talk about this? And it was interesting that that one response was the only response that came up. I mean, once the person said it's not worth talking about, then nobody said anything, and I didn't know where to go from there. You know, not in a group with eight people. If I was with him privately, I might have a follow-up question.
Right.
Now, Mike, we live in a world, and particularly the Western world, where science, I think, in some respects, has kind of a privileged position. That science is seen as a very valuable enterprise. It gives us real knowledge about the way the world works. And so when a scientist talks about faith and science, that's news. And I know you are not only a professor, but you go out and give apologetic talks. I wonder if you would tell us, how do you approach that topic? What do you think are some of the better arguments for God, or what's your apologetic methodology of addressing some of these things?
Yeah, I mean, first let's address your preface. The one person once said to me, you know, as a scientist, you're the high priest of the day. And do you use that to your advantage? Are you taking advantage of that? And my answer was absolutely yes. Right. I mean, if Richard Dawkins is going to take advantage of it to, you know, give really poor philosophical reasons for atheism, then I'm going to take advantage of it to hopefully give some good reasons for theism.
Very good.
And so, you know, my approach is one of congruence, right? That if there is the Christian God, if he is real, and if he's the creator of the universe, then he should give a consistent message in any message he gives. And so the message of nature, his creative work, should be consistent with, if it's the Christian God, with the Bible, which is, you know, the book we believe he authored. I have a friend who is an artist. He's a very good artist. One of his paintings actually hangs in the Oklahoma State Capitol building. And he says, when you look at a piece of art, you see the soul of the artist. And so God's creation is his piece of art, right? Mm-hmm. And the same way that an art critic can look at a piece of art and see intricacies that I can't, as a scientist, I get to look at God's creation and hopefully see intricacies that the layperson might not see. And so my approach is to go to a general audience and say, as a scientist, here are the things that I see that give evidence for God. And the fact that I'm a scientist, yes, it gives me credibility. I will consistently go to a university that invites other speakers in to talk about Christianity and whatever, and they will consistently say, even though nobody knows who I am, that this is the largest audience we've had.
Wow.
So what's bringing people? It's not who I am. It's what the message is, that there's scientific evidence for God.
So you kind of have the two books idea. There's the book of nature, there's the book of scripture, there is this congruence between the two of them. If they're the author of both books, they're going to agree.
And in fact, you know, there are some Christians who want to minimize the book of nature and maximize the written word. And that's okay. So let's start with the book of scripture. What does it say? For since the creation of the world, God's invisible characteristics, his divine nature and eternal power are clearly seen through what has been made. Romans 1:20, right? Or Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies show the work of his hands. So if I was to start with sola scriptura, right, I would still come to the conclusion that there's a second book of Revelation.
Very good.
And I think that's important because there are some people who accuse us who think that the two books, you know, both give a consistent picture of God. They accuse us of putting the book of nature over the book of scripture. And I would turn that around and say, no, I put such high value on the book of nature because that's what scripture tells me to do.
Wow. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about cosmology. I mean, What is it about the universe in which we live that you think speaks so powerfully in congruence with Scripture? Is it the beginning of the universe? Is it the fine-tuning? What elements do you think are so powerful in pointing to God?
Yes. I'm just waiting for you to set me up with that. I mean, those are the two I start with. 100 years ago, if you had said that we would have any evidence for the history of the universe, its beginning, most scientists would have probably not even thought that was possible. Yeah. And so the fact that the evidence for a beginning to the space-time matter and energy of this universe has become second nature to all of us, right? The argument is whether or not it had a real beginning, even though it looks like it did, because the real beginning means the possibility of a beginner, right? We all know this, and anyone who's listened to Reasons to Believe Material knows this. And it is to me overwhelming that it doesn't just convince everyone. Mm-hmm. So there's a famous quote by Arthur Eddington when Hubble first discovered that the universe was expanding and it looked like it had an origin. And the quote is often used by theists to show that scientists are philosophically opposed to the origin. And he says that, you know, the fact that the universe has a beginning or has an origin is repugnant. I would like to find an actual loophole. And we look at that and say, well, why did Eddington think it was repugnant? And I can't find the answer for sure, but I think the real answer is because Eddington was a theist. And Eddington thought that if the universe had a beginning, then no one would have an excuse for not believing in God. Wow. And that no God would ever make it that obvious. And so we don't use the quote that way. We use it the other way to say that, you know, no one wants a beginning. But I believe, I can't find this for certain, but I believe in the context, that's what Eddington was saying. And so, and I think that's true. It's if the universe had a beginning, then you could not have picked a better scenario to say there must be a transcendent cause. Now, when I talk to my skeptic friends about this, they will say, yeah, but the cause doesn't have to be God. There might be another transcendent cause. And I say, yes, that's true. But you're admitting that you have a transcendent cause.
Wow.
You know, from science.
Wow.
And I had one guy say, well, don't use the word transcendent because that sounds too much like deity. And I said, go look up transcendent. It means, you know, not a part of this universe.
Right.
Wow. Let me ask you a question in that regard. So, you know, the middle latter part of the 20th century, Big Bang cosmology really came to bear that, you know, matter, energy, space, and time appear to have had a beginning. But, you know, the cosmological argument had been around a long time. There have been Christians who believed that for centuries, but they didn't necessarily have any direct empirical or scientific support for it. And I guess the question I have for you there is, does that give us any insight or awareness that it could be that Christianity and science could be in conflict, but that's not necessarily a reason to give it up? I mean, a lot of scientists believe in evolution. Are there times where we have to live with tensions between faith and science?
Well, yeah, I think there are times we have to live with tension, right? And it's not just with faith and science, it's with faith and the human experience, right? But if there is an infinite God, then I'm obviously going to live in some tension because he's incomprehensible to me. But I think, you know, if Christianity is true, then discovery should ultimately, to some extent, validate the cosmological argument, right? Now, again, if you had asked people 100 years ago, can we ever validate the first premise that the universe had a beginning, you would have got mixed reactions. A lot of people would have said no. But the fact that we have makes that, and you know, it's not just the Kalam, is that how you say it? You know, cosmological argument. Yeah. It's now based on the fact that the evidence says the universe has a beginning.
Now, in extending that kind of cosmological presentation that you give, and I, by the way, get emails, people telling me how great your apologetic talks are. Talk to us a little bit about fine-tuning. What's so impressive about that? Why is that a pointer to God in your mind?
Yeah, so the fine-tuning is the fact that the parameters of the universe, things like the ratio of the gravitational strength to the strong nuclear force strength, or things like that, the mass of the light quarks that make up the proton, that they're fall within very narrow ranges. And if you were to change the range just a little bit, if you change their value just a little bit, you would either have no universe at all, in many cases, or a universe that's inhospitable to life. And so it looks like it's designed. And so the question is, where does that design come from? And I think it's a very powerful argument. In all other facets of our life, if we see something that looks like it's designed, we will say there is a real designer. And so here we have a universe that looks like it's designed, I mean, really well designed. And this is where the scientific knowledge comes in. I can point to things that I've studied or researched myself that gives evidence for design. You know, I see the design in a way that only the art critic can see. And so if the universe looks designed, you have to ask the question, is there a real designer behind it all?
Mike, one of the topics that my colleague Jeff Swearing addresses is this question of the multiverse. You know, maybe there is an unknown number of universes out there, and our universe is just one of those. And of course, the reasoning is that maybe we can explain this fine-tuning in that if you have enough universes, there's going to be one that have all of these purely accidentally. Richard Swinburne, who is a leading Christian philosopher, said, why should I assume a near infinite number of universes to explain something that a single God can explain? Well, what are your thoughts a little bit about the multiverse as an explanation? How do you work through that?
I think the multiverse is the explanation nowadays for people who don't believe in God. In fact, I'll plug a non-RTB book. There's a book that just came out by two Australian scientists called A Fortunate Universe, Luke Barnes and Grant Lewis. Luke is a postdoc. They're both astrophysicists. And Luke is a believer in God.
Okay.
And Grant Lewis is a believer in the multiverse. Mm-hmm. And the book is fascinating because most of the book is the evidence for fine-tuning. And they both agree, whether you're a non-theist or a theist, that the universe is clearly fine-tuned. It lies in an extremely rare parameter space, and there has to be some explanation. And then the last half of the book is written almost like a dialogue between the two, where one is going to invoke the multiverse as the reason for it, and they're going to critique that. And one is going to invoke God as the reason for it, and they're going to critique that. And it's funny because I've been reading this book off and on for a long time. I was reading it on the flight here, finishing up. And as I read Luke Barnes' dialogue about why he thinks the best explanation is God, it sounds to me, I'm a little biased, but it sounds to me so much better than the multiverse explanation. Now, you know, science has often discovered something that was totally unexpected. You know, quantum mechanics is a good example of that. Relativity is a good example of that. And who knows? Someday we may discover a multiverse. And I think the question we have to ask is, does a multiverse solve the fine-tuning problem, first of all? And does a multiverse give evidence against a theistic worldview? And I would have to say that the answer to both of those questions is no. Mm-hmm. First of all, a multiverse doesn't necessarily solve any fine-tuning problem. As one person wrote about string theory that predicts a multiverse, a theory that predicts everything actually predicts nothing, right? And so it's not clear that if we discovered a multiverse, it necessarily solves the fine-tuning problem. We would still most likely be in a very, very rare universe where things like Boltzmann brains are much more probable. I don't know if we need to explain that, but... And then the second question is, does it take away from God? Well, no, because in almost any multiverse theory, you still have to have a beginning. The Borde-Guth-Wilenkin theory pretty much requires that, you know, any theory has a beginning. Any laws of physics have a beginning. And you have to start asking questions. So here's a scenario. This may be far beyond what you want. Suppose string theory is true. Suppose God decides to create a universe in which string theory is the foundation on which everything works. Well, string theory has this landscape of 10 to the 500 universes. Now, that doesn't mean you necessarily have to actualize those, but it's got that many ways to make universes. So let's say God wants to make a single universe with moral beings on it, and he's going to use string theory as the underlying principle. And the only way to make string theory work is to use these 10 to the 500 landscapes to create one universe.
Wow.
It's a lot of universes.
So you would say that 10 to the 500 would be the minimum number of universes you could have if you wanted to create one with moral beings in it. Now, we've had the same conversation before, because the question about the size of the universe always comes up. That the universe is so big, how could humans have any significance? And then you start to do the math. And you find out if you start with a Big Bang, you have to have the correct matter density of the universe, and it has to expand at the correct rate. And humans come along. So the size of the universe is correlated with the age of the universe, and humans come along the earliest we possibly could. Therefore, we have the smallest universe we possibly could. Mm. So despite the fact that the universe is some 50 billion light years apart across the visible universe, you start to go, well, this is the smallest universe you could have and have a single planet with sentient moral beings on it. Maybe 10 to the 500 universes is the minimum you can have if string theory is what underlies it all. I mean, you just don't know. Right. So here's my take on the science. Until you have the mathematical theory that describes the real multiverse that we can observe somehow, until we have that, we can't really tell you what the multiverse says about God and fine-tuning or anything.
Let me broaden the...
Was that too technical?
No, it's good. Very good. You speak conversationally and clearly, yeah, and good. I really like that.
10 to the 500.
I always, when you comment like that, that's the way Richard Feynman always was. Yeah. When you listened to him, you thought, wow, this is fantastic. I understand it. But then you try and go home and do the homework, and you realize I didn't have all the clever insights that
that's right.
Richard Feynman
so,
had.
This is I continually get this feedback when I speak. And this, if we could talk about the book, this is a little bit about that, is that people tell me that you have the ability to take really complex ideas and, and make them understandable mostly. And so that, I think, you know, there's a lot of people who write great books on science Christianity who speak, but I think the thing I have to add to the conversation is to say to, you know, the homeschool mom, here's something that you can maybe understand and maybe grasp and maybe help your kids understand that if you read a more technical book, you might not be able to get.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. Both C.S. Lewis and Mortimer Adler, two of my prized thinkers, they both said that if you can't take a complex subject and talk about it in a meaningful way that a broad range of people can get something, then maybe you don't understand it as clearly as you think. And so I like what you're doing, and it's the feedback that I hear, you know, when I get these emails.
But what I would say is it's not for most of my colleagues, it's not necessarily they don't understand it. It's that they don't have a connection between where the that's the wrong term, but where the non-technical person actually is compared to their understanding.
I have a question along those lines, Ken, if you don't mind.
Sure, jump in.
When it you talked about some of the big stuff. I want to go real small now.
Yeah.
You mentioned SLAC and CERN. Dave, you're a physicist. I want to hear what the latest is along those lines when it comes to particle physics. Are we getting any closer to some major discovery? Tell us about the Higgs boson and these little tiny things, anything big up and coming, and what can we understand about these tiny particles? What should we understand about what's going on at that very, very small level?
Well, I think with the tiny particles, the more you delve into it, the more you see design and fine-tuning. So in the 1960s, we began to develop a model of what we thought were the fundamental particles and forces of the universe. We call it the Standard Model. You can think of it like a jigsaw puzzle. And gradually, the pieces fell into place. In the 1980s, we discovered the particles called the W and Z, which were actually predicted by this model. In 1995, we discovered the top quark, which is actually predicted by this model. And so as we put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle into place, there was one piece missing. And that piece is named after Peter Higgs, one of the six physicists who predicted it. And so there was about a 40-50 year search for this particle from the time it was predicted to the time it was discovered. And, you know, billions of dollars spent, and it was discovered in 2012. It was the last piece of this jigsaw puzzle of our understanding of the universe. We know that the jigsaw puzzle is only a part of a bigger picture. Why do we know that? Because there are things we can see their effect in the universe that we don't know what are causing the effect. Dark matter is a gravitational effect that we see happening, but we can't explain it with just the matter we know of. Dark energy is a force in the universe that we see its effect, but we don't know what it is. So we know we're missing something. We know this Standard Model puzzle is just a small piece of a bigger puzzle. And what that bigger puzzle is, no one has a clue. And we're extremely frustrated because we thought that the Large Hadron Collider at CERN would tell us the bigger picture, and so far it hasn't. Now, we're going to keep running it at least till 2035. There's plans about maybe building another machine after that. But if you talk to most particle physicists right now about, you know, what they feel about the field, it's just extreme frustration that nature hasn't given us a peek behind the curtain as to what the next thing is. And so we will continue to run this machine. There's lots of ways to make discoveries and look for what that next peace may look like. Whoever finds it will win a Nobel Prize, and it will open up a whole new avenue for exploration. And the Higgs boson gives us some idea of where to look. But if you look, you know, if you look under the lamppost and there's nothing there, there's not much you can do.
Can we find out, I guess part of the question is this T minus the early part of the universe is what I'm getting at. What do
right.
they call it? T minus?
Yeah, so as you get to higher and higher energies in your colliders, you probe farther back in time.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, if you could build a collider that's an order of magnitude more powerful, that would be a huge jump. But that's just going from 10 to the minus 12 seconds to 10 to the minus 13 seconds after the Big Bang. Mm. It's not really a huge jump going backwards in time. So, you know, to get to where inflation might have occurred at 10 to the minus 32 is 20 orders of magnitude larger than we are, big, higher energy than what we are now. That's not going to happen.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
Right. So we will continue to probe the origin. But if you want to say, can I create in my collider the conditions that existed right after inflation, the answer is no. I can create the conditions that existed right now to about 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 13 seconds after the origin, if there was an actual origin, after T equals zero.
Okay.
And you're not, and again, you know, the next machine we're talking about a factor of 10 in energy, so it pushes it back one order of magnitude. But we're not going to get to T equals zero. It'd take the entire, by definition, it takes the entire energy of the universe right, to get to T equals
what
zero.
What does CERN cost? Do you know, a ballpark figure?
The Large Hadron Collider, the machine we work on, cost about $10 billion, which really, and if you look at what governments in the world, Western world, spend, it's, you know, nothing. What's the budget of a U.S.? A couple trillion. So $10 billion is the kind of chump change.
Yeah.
You know?
So you spend a couple of airplanes.
Yeah.
What, by the way,
a little more than the RTB budget.
What would have the superconducting super collider, would it have been more powerful?
Yes. Don't get me started on that.
What was it?
So we're running at 13 TeV.
Right.
Is this in the U.S. now?
No, it's CERN in Geneva.
All right.
So, you know, you don't have to worry about the units. 13 is the number.
Okay.
The super collider that was going to be built in Texas and was shut down would have been 40.
Oh, wow.
So okay. No one's even talking about a 40 machine yet.
Right.
So the questions we're trying to answer would have already been answered if the U.S. had just spent another $10 billion.
Right.
Which, again...
They already spent, what, eight or something?
Well, it depends on how you do the budget and how you deal with the lawsuits that were incurred. And right. They spent a few billion. Yeah. And a few billion more would have finished the machine. And the world would have been coming to us for the answers instead of me having to send graduate students and postdocs to Europe. But don't get me started on that because we don't want to be bitter 25 years later, right?
Okay, Mike, you're a smart guy, so I'm going to ask you a philosophy of science question here. It seems to me that when really smart people want to solve challenging questions, they appeal to what I would call the preconditions of reality. They appeal to math. They appeal to logic. They appeal to empirical scientific thinking. C.S. Lewis would say they appeal to imagination. My question is, how do we explain those things? If those are the tools we reach for when we want to try to explain the meaning of reality, how do we explain those things? And thus my question is, a lot of atheists, particularly the outspoken new atheists, got a lot of bravado. They would say that we have a simple worldview. People like Mike Strauss have a very complicated one, and Mike Strauss's Christian worldview requires extraordinary evidence. But here's my question for you. I mean, explaining consciousness, explaining mind, personhood, reason, it seems to me that the naturalist worldview is really telling us that those incredibly complex and meaningful phenomena came from something that lacked all of those qualities. And for me, I mean, okay, maybe there's some things about God that are tough to understand, and maybe there are presuppositions that we have to wrestle with. But if there is an infinite mind that has power to create, I'm not all that surprised that he creates finite minds like mine. But it seems like if extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, where's the evidence that all of this came from? Does that strike you as being a huge challenge for naturalism?
Yeah, there's a lot there, right, Ken? It strikes me as being a huge challenge for naturalism, but I'm not sure it would strike my colleagues as being a huge challenge to naturalism. Naturalism is so ingrained. Plus, I think the Christian worldview has been presented really poorly many times, right? God of the gaps is a bad way to present the Christian worldview, but it's been presented that way over and over again, right? My Christian my non-believing scientific colleagues believe the rhetoric that at one time we thought lightning was caused by the gods, and then we understand it, and so it's electromagnetism. And that's you follow that path down its logical conclusion, and everything becomes explainable by naturalism.
So give us enough time.
Give us enough time, enough insight.
We'll work it out.
Yep.
Even though it's consciousness.
Right. Well, the buzzword today is emergence, right?
Yeah.
Everything can emerge somehow from simple things, right? Even though emergence explains nothing, it explains everything. And yeah, I think, you know, if we're going to use God of the gaps arguments, then we're setting ourselves up for this scenario. But, you know, those of us who really understand the good arguments for God don't point to things we don't understand, the gaps. We point to the things we do understand and say those give us good evidence for God. So I think they would argue that that a natural explanation will eventually be found for everything. But let's take a step back, right, to what you started with. Mathematics and logic, why are they the foundation for anything, right? That's more of a philosophical question. That's the question that my colleagues never ask. Why is it that Peter Higgs in 1963 could put some scratches on a piece of paper and say, oh, there must be a particle in nature that we've never discovered. Let's spend $20 billion and go find it.
Wow.
I mean, to me, that sounds like an engineer designing something, right?
Yeah,
and he can discover that with mathematics. I mean, even my colleagues find that amazing, But they don't take it a step farther. Why is the universe described by mathematics that really, you know, tells you what the universe is like?
It just works.
It just works, right. It just works.
Now, one of the ironies, I'm the non-scientist on the scholar team, so I'm the oddball.
That's why we really like you. Yeah.
And I've shared this on this program that I find it ironic that, you know, the scientific enterprise seeks to recruit some of the brightest, most thoughtful people. It provides them with some of the best possible training, sets them up with funds to do these projects, prizing reason, rationality, thought, reflection, inference, only to draw a conclusion shared by many, not all, but shared by many scientists, that all of this came from a non-rational source. Am I alone in that irony?
Well, I think you phrase it in a way that makes it ironic, right? What my colleagues would say is we are trying to describe or explain nature and it works. We have cell phones because it works. Why go beyond that? You know, the anthropic principle that the universe seems designed for humans. Most of my colleagues stop at what's called the weak anthropic principle, right? Mm-hmm. If we didn't fit this environment, we wouldn't be here. With no further question as to beyond that. We're here. Yes, it looks designed. Yes, it looks fine-tuned, but you know,
that's enough.
If it was any other way, we wouldn't be here. And the fact that we're here, it's the fallacy of the firing squad, right?
Yeah.
The 100 sharpshooters that miss, and you just go, well, I'm here, so they must have all missed.
Right.
And never ask, well, why did they miss? Mm-hmm. How did they miss? What's going on beyond the fact that they shouldn't miss, but they did?
Let me ask you another question. Now, obviously, you look at the two books, and that congruence between the two of them is a very powerful element. But is that the only thing, or is that even the central thing that drives you to faith? That yeah. Is there something other than maybe you're looking at those? Now, those are two pretty big books. They yeah. encompass a lot. But, you know, I've met people that are very reasonable and rational, and I ask them, well, why are you a person of faith? And they'll tell me, the Lord answered my prayer.
Yeah. I'll tell you why I am a Christian. It's because I think the answers, that the Christian answers answer globally the questions more than any other worldview. It's not, you know, if I've sat on juries. There's never a smoking gun on a jury. Mm-hmm. You take all the evidence together and you say, which hypothesis fits all the evidence best? And when I look at the human experience, whether it's from science, whether it's from history, whether it's from philosophy, whether mm-hmm. it's from sociology, and ask what worldview seems to answer the questions that each of these fields brings up in the most consistent way, it's the Christian worldview. Right? Why do we have social problems? The Christian worldview has a reasonable answer for that. Why did the universe have beginning? A very different question. The Christian worldview has the best answer for that. And so I don't think there's a single thing that says, this is why I'm a Christian. You know, if God answers prayer, the Christian worldview tells you why that happens, right? It's the most cohesive worldview that answers the questions in a reasonable way that's satisfying. And then, of course, you know, the one event is the resurrection of Jesus. People always say, well, Christianity is unfalsifiable, and that's absolutely false. Christianity is very falsifiable. All you have to do is find the unambiguous bones of Jesus, and everything we believe is not true, right? So, it is that historical, verifiable, objective event that is the ultimate evidence for the truth of the Christian message.
So in philosophy, we would talk about a breadth of explanation, that it has explanatory power and scope, and you seem to be speaking of a cumulative case of data.
Including how come the University of Oklahoma has a successful football program. That fits in there somehow.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that's maybe far from the Christian worldview. I don't know.
But maybe you can get your colleagues to talk about it.
Yeah. Mike, let me turn the tables on you then. What in your mind is the biggest challenge that the Christian worldview has to face? What do you think is something that you think is a substantive challenge that you have to dig in?
Well, I think there's a difference between the biggest challenge, I think, and the biggest obstacles.
Okay.
Right. I think naturalism is the biggest worldview that's predominant in the Western world now, right? And it goes without thinking about the philosophical underpinnings, right? People just think that science can and will explain everything with natural explanations. And those aren't even explanations. As Stephen Hawking says, you know, who puts the fire into the equations? Writing an equation doesn't bring the universe into being. Writing the standard model doesn't make the quarks do what they do. It describes what they do. But I think in our interaction with people who are not believers, the biggest obstacle is probably naturalism, that there is nothing beyond this.
The people that you identified earlier who are apathetic, would you say that they hold to naturalism?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. A philosophical naturalism. Mm-hmm. I think for me, the biggest challenge to Christianity is, I mean, in some sense I'd say the problem of evil, but it's not that so much as the fact that life isn't what I want it to be, right? And everybody faces that. And to me, you know, the problem of evil is the philosophical maybe wording for that. But why is it that I have to put up with the challenges of life, right? The personal experience. And even I think science can answer that to some degree. So I often talk about the book Flatland. Do you know this book, right? Mm-hmm. So Flatland is a book that describes a universe that's only two-dimensional, and there's a three-dimensional being like you and I, a spacelander, trying to describe himself to the flatlander. And as you read the book, you realize that it's utterly impossible for a three-dimensional being to describe himself to a two-dimensional world, right? And God is more than a multi-dimensional being. That would be some minimal model of God. And the book Flatland helps me understand, to me, the biggest challenges to Christianity is that I don't understand what God is doing. If there is a God who is all good and all powerful and could make any universe he wants, why this one? Why the evil? Why the suffering? And the answer is because he's a spacelander and I'm a flatlander. And Isaiah 55 says that. It says, for as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are God's ways above man's ways. Right? And well, we know a little bit from cosmology how high the heavens are above the earth. And me trying to understand the challenges to Christianity, the world that I don't think is fair at times, the world that I don't think should exist at times, I have to go back to say, well, the Creator is the spacelander, and of course his ways are so much different than mine that I can't. And I think somebody who understands multi-dimensions and can write the equation for a four-dimensional sphere gets some insight into what that is like. And it helps me, I don't know right the word, live with the fact that the universe itself, the things I don't like about the universe, the problems I have, are slightly incomprehensible because the Creator of the universe is slightly incomprehensible. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. In line with that, in line with trying to make sense of the things we find uncomfortable or wrestling with the things that seem beyond our ability to comprehend, what do you think? What do you think is maybe some of the challenges to people like you who want to make an intellectual case for the truth of Christianity? That is, you know, I'll tell you something I struggle with is I believe profoundly that we're saved by grace. Mm. It's not anything I do. It's what God has done in the person of Christ. And God has forgiven what I think is the inexcusable actions of myself. And yet I struggle to extend that graciousness and that to people who disagree with me. And I think, wow, this is a cognitive dissonance. How can I talk about grace and struggle? Is there a... Are there struggles that apologists have in your mind that we have to watch out for?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot, right? One of those, I think, is that you can argue someone into changing their beliefs, right? We know that arguments don't necessarily change minds. Arguments give some reasons why another worldview might be viable. People ask me all the time, how do you help an intellectual scientist come to faith? And my answer is, you show them the love of Christ, right? Sure, you need to answer their intellectual questions. Sure, you need to show them that the Christian worldview is viable. But people come to Christ because he offers something that nobody else can offer. And we as Christians need to show people what Christ has to offer. And I think the apologist can point too much to the logic and the math and the reason and sometimes forget that part of that is pointing to Christ. A great scientist, really an outstanding scientist, is James Torr, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And you listen to James Torr talk, and yeah, he talks about his brilliant science that he's doing. And then you hear him share his testimony of how he came to Christ and what Christ has to offer. And you go, that's a powerful message. That's more powerful than the origin of the universe being evidence for God. I mean, I need to build a intellectual foundation for what I believe. Jesus said that you got to love God with your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Mind is an important part. But ultimately, it's everything that Jesus has to offer that draws people to himself. I mean, the best thing we can do as apologists is use the evidence for God to point to the person of Christ, not mm-hmm. to point to the wonderful logic that we have, or the two books even, right?
Yeah.
My dad was a pastor, and one of the most profound things he ever said, I mean, he was a really good pastor. You would come out of the sermon going, that was awesome. And he once said something that has had a huge influence on me when I talk. He says, when people come out of church, I don't want them to say, what a great sermon. I want them to say, what a great Savior.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
What a difference, yeah. right? One points to me as I have the answers. One points to Christ as he has the answers. Mm-hmm. And the apologist's mission is to say, I have reasons for what I believe. And there are good reasons, and there are reasons you need to pay attention to, but ultimately, if that's not the answer, the answer is Christ. Mm-hmm. Christians are followers of Christ. We think he has the answers. And to the extent that I quit pointing to him, is I'm not doing the right job. Now, again, there's appropriate places. If I stand up, you know, in a university and I'm going to give scientific evidence for God, the Christian message of pointing to Christ may be a very, very small part of that, if at all, because I look at this as one step in a process, right? But the ultimate process better get to, it's not about me, it's not about my intellect, it's not about my arguments, it's about what Jesus has to offer people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to touch on two things before our time's up. You mentioned your dad. I want you to tell us a little bit about your family. And then I want you to tell us about this book you're working on and other books you've worked on.
Let me, before you do that, it's interesting that the first thing I heard about Mike from my friend, our common friend, Jeff Steinman, was that Mike was the black sheep of his family.
Uh-oh.
I've been described that for many ways. Yeah. Wow. So my dad was a pastor. My grandfather was a pastor. I have three brothers. They all are professional Christian work. One was a missionary and a seminary professor. He's since passed away. One's a seminary professor. One is a missionary. And so, you know, when I came to every fork in the road, I had no role models for science, simply role models for theology. And I just, I was totally naive. I had no idea what a PhD in physics meant. I had no idea what a particle physicist was. I had no idea anything about science. I just liked science. And through a remarkable set of circumstances, God led me to science. So it really is, again, it's a long story. I've told it a couple times in public, but it's a story of a naive kid having God's direction when he didn't even know it. So the book came about because I've given people many RTB books because they're so good. Mm-hmm. And I have a huge number of people that I give them to that I think are well-educated, they have college degrees, and they really can't understand them as well as they're written. And so I wrote a book that I thought was more accessible a little bit. It's called The Creator Revealed. It talks about the two books, how the origin of the universe agrees with Scripture, and goes through some of the account of Genesis. And my goal was to write a book that the average person could read. I went to a number of publishers because my brother has connections with publishers since he's a theologian, and nobody would publish the book. And the reason was because one person said to my face, "You're writing to an audience that doesn't exist. The Christians who buy books on science are those who are more technically minded, and you're trying to write a book to the non-technically minded." And so this book was written 10 years ago. It sat on the shelf, and about a year ago, I decided, one publisher told me, "You should self-publish it and prove us wrong, because we don't believe there's a market." And I've talked to a number of publishers since, and they've all said the same thing. "You're writing a book with no market." And so I finally decided, I don't care if there's a market or not. I speak a lot. People are constantly asking me, "Do you have something that the average person can understand that explains what you believe about the origin of the universe and a little bit about the fine-tuning?" And I finally said, "Well, we're going to put something out there and we'll see if there's a market." But for me, it's not about a market. It's about the message, right? Mm-hmm. We'll see. It'll be published by Westbow Publishing, which is Zondervan's self-publishing arm. And I'm working through a few final details, but hopefully it'll be out in a couple weeks or so. The Creator Revealed, a scientist looks at the Big Bang in the Bible.
Wow.
Great.
Is the name.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Mike, it's such a privilege to have you come and visit RTB and to be on Straight Thinking. You always stimulate my thinking, so thank you.
Likewise.
For being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right.
It's been really great.
Okay, thank you, Mike. You've been with RTB for how long now?
As a 27 years, wow. Something 27 like that.
Years.
I've
okay.
been associated with you guys.
Yeah, you've taught courses too, right? Have you been?
I've done a lot of things.
Okay.
Yes,
spoken on behalf of RTB.
Yeah.
So
nice.
People definitely know you on the apologetics community for sure. All right, The Creator Revealed. Be sure to get a copy of that and spread the word. Thanks again. Okay, for Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.